You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, November 29th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, political philosopher from Duke University, Michael Hart, co-author of Assembly, parenthetical, heretical thought. Also on the program, North Korea reportedly has an ICBM that can presumably hit New York and D.C. based on the report of a test, or I should say a test and a report from the Defense Department. Republican Senate committee passes the tax proposal bill, now heads to the floor. Passage is looking more and more real, folks. Meanwhile, a Trump-appointed judge rules in favor of the Trump-appointed head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders propose a Marshall Plan for Puerto Rico. And a shutdown may loom, even though Republicans control both houses of Congress. How is that possible? All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, a couple of housekeeping notes. First off, some of you might be aware of a controversy that was attempted to be manufactured on Twitter regarding a tweet that I had tweeted back in 2009. And it was a controversy that was attempted to be generated by a man who apparently is not too happy with how we have mocked him in the past.
Suffering Thuckatad.
That, of course, is a character from a Warner Brothers cartoon.
Based on
a Warner Brothers cartoon. Right. Yes. Yeah. I will be addressing this more extensively at the end of this program, because I know there are people who are interested in finding out what happened.
At Pizza.
Yes. Also, I should tell you this is Cyber Week, ladies and gentlemen. Cyber Week. Cameron Hughes, and you've heard me talk about Cameron Hughes wine, right? This is the wine where the winery has relationships with super high-end wineries around the world. They buy their extra juice, essentially. Some wineries, I know all this just because my sister worked in this business. They only want to put out like 15,000 bottles of a wine. Smaller wines. That's the way they maintain, I guess, the value of their wine, or that's their quality control. I don't know exactly, but it's usually they only want to put out a certain amount. Maintains the price point for them. But often, they may have a bumper year in terms of crops 5 years ago or something like that. So they've got extra juice or wine. In the biz, you call it juice. And Cameron Hughes goes around and they look for the extra wine from these high-end wineries. And then they bottle it in their bottle. They call it lot number 619. They tell you the grape and the region in which it comes from. And then they sell it to you at a significantly lower price than if you went and purchased the wine with the other label on it. It's good wine. And it's as far as I can tell, it's mostly like big West Coast wines. They have an amazing deal. And unfortunately, it ends Friday at December 1st. I don't know if we got this copy too late or what, because it's cyber week. It's really, really cyber a couple of days. But it's 30% off and free shipping. And on a case, 30% off and free shipping on a case and free gift bags. I'm not sure what's in the gift bags, but it's this week only. The offer ends Friday. The wine won't last. This really is a no-brainer. I've ordered repeatedly from Cameron Hughes now. I'm drinking too much these days. It's a no-brainer. You get up to an additional 30% off and free shipping. So instead of getting a $150 wine for $30, this weekend you can get it for even less. 30% off wine and free shipping and... this is on a case and a free gift bags on your order. It's 1 week only. And you can only get up to 30% off and free shipping if you use my code MAJORITY. You got to use the code MAJORITY at checkout. Go to chwine.com. That's chwine.com. Enter my special code MAJORITY. It's a special code, folks. And it's MAJORITY. And you get 30% off and free shipping. Get any wine for 30% off? Go to chwine.com, enter code MAJORITY. Don't worry, because this offer is available only until midnight Friday. I don't know if that's East Coast or West Coast, but don't mess around with it. Just wherever. If you're on the East Coast, just pretend that it's 8:30 p.m. is when the deadline ends. So check that out. For those of you who might be very concerned about what's going on with North Korea, don't worry, because the president is on it.
Do you believe there will be government shutdown if the president is? Would you blame Democrats if that happens?
Would you blame that happens? I would absolutely blame the Democrats. If it happens, it's going to be over illegals pouring into the country, crime pouring into the country. No border wall.
All right, pause it. I'm sorry. Wants. This is a clip of Donald Trump. It's only the headline. I thought that he had just come up and said on North Korea, we'll take care of it, he said. But this is Donald Trump attempting to blame the Democrats for the potential of a government shutdown. I want to remind you that the government, both houses, are controlled by Republicans. And of course, it is the Democrats who are going to be responsible for shutting down the government. Presumably, this is going to happen through a pizza shop. But here is Donald Trump.
I would absolutely blame the Democrats. If it happens, it's going to be over illegals pouring into the country, crime pouring into the country, no border wall, which everybody wants. I got elected partially because of a border wall. You look at the military, we want strong funding for the military. They don't. So many things. As an example, they want high taxes. We want cut taxes. We're going to cut taxes. We're going to reform. We're going to simplify. They want high taxes. We want low taxes. So there's a lot of big differences. So we'll see what happens as to shutdown. We'll see. But right now, things have changed over the last 2 hours because 2 hours ago, a missile was launched. I think that will have a huge effect on Schumer and Pelosi. I think. We'll see. We'll learn very soon. They should be calling immediately and say, we want to see you, but probably they won't, because nothing to them is important other than raising taxes. That's the only thing they like doing, is raising taxes. Thank you all very much.
There's Donald Trump apparently addressing a room full of 7-year-olds who would buy the idea that Schumer and Pelosi don't care about a missile to New York or California, I guess, presumably, right? Just care about raising taxes. That's the only thing they want to talk to.
Leverage up a deal with NK to raise taxes in exchange for, sacrificing some city. I mean, obviously we would do it.
it's possible that maybe Schumer and Pelosi right now are secretly in talks with North Korea to load those ICBMs up with huge tax bills.
That's right.
And it'll just shower upon us. Yeah, this guy, there's a real sense that, and I guess we've always had this sense, but there's, like, you know, that moment like when the water is simmering and it's about to boil over. I really do have the sense, like, I think, because he's sitting there holding himself together, like physically holding himself together. Like, he, like, I don't think I've ever seen a president ever address, I don't think I've ever seen, like, really many people address, like, a crowd of people, like, where they actually have to hug themselves.
Well, you have, because you've seen him talk a couple of weeks ago. He does that periodically.
I don't think I've ever noticed it as
he distinct. Actually, that was his body posture when he threatened to annihilate North Korea the first time.
I'm holding myself in.
Right.
There does appear to be, at this moment, a very strong likelihood, as I've been saying for a long time, that the tax bill and budget is going to pass. But there's also an upcoming vote on raising the debt ceiling, and the Democrats are needed to add their votes into this, possibly, in the House. And they are going to leverage, I think, some immigration protections, at the very least, for DACA recipients. So it remains to be seen. But there's Donald Trump. He's on top of it. We will talk about the Twitter controversy. Oh, I should also tell you this. And this is completely coincidental. And we may be trying to start it back up. But our Amazon account has been shut down. So if you have plans to buy anything on Amazon, just know that that link will take you to Amazon, but we will get no credit for it. We're hoping to reinstitute a new one maybe tomorrow, but this has happened apparently to other groups. Supposedly, we violated the terms by using their logo inappropriately.
Well, now is the time to opt out of monopolistic final stage capitalism.
That's
no
right.
No more Amazon until tomorrow.
I was doing really inappropriate things with the logo.
Or, yes, it was disgusting.
It was a little
and
disturbing.
Or you can just check out Jet.com.
Yeah.
And go to MajorityReportKickback.com. Go to Jet.com. You're going to find that the service is just as good. You may not be as used to the interface, but it's pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Jet is also not necessarily, you know,
the minimum
owned by Walmart,
but it is, yes.
But I guess some competition better than none.
Foiled again.
Yes, foiled
again.
Sorry. yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I've got the taste, ladies and gentlemen. One of the things I just got to say before we go to the break is that, and I think, you know, longtime listeners of this program know this, that if I have, like, a cookie, I have to have, like, a 10. That's why we can't have any sweets in this office. And also,
it's
like,
really true. I mean,
I'm not joking. Anybody
when
knows
sweets
me knows
are around.
And, but it's also the same way with, like, if I feel like I've gotten under, you know, if I've, like, if someone reacts to me on Twitter like that, that I was like someone who I like wouldn't personally like reacts in a way that suggests to me that my gentle needling is in some way impacting them. That's like me having like a sugar cookie and there are like 10 others in the office. So
sure.
I just want to apologize to the audience right now about
we're gonna indulge
what's going to happen
for a very long time.
All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, before we go on to the juvenile stuff, we're going to talk to Michael Hart, political philosopher from Duke, on his latest assembly, Heretical Thought. We'll be right back.
Hey, baby, you know it's true. I'm in love with you, baby.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Michael Hart. He is a political philosopher from Duke University, co-author of Assembly, Heretical Thought, along with Antonio Negri, also the two co-authored the Empire Trilogy, including Empire, Multitude, and Commonwealth. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So, all right, let's. I'm trying to figure out like where the best entry is into this. But I guess, how about an assessment of where we are in terms of capitalism in this day and age as its development progressed?
That's a hard one. Like, let me start at a slightly different angle because sure. because it's a big question. I mean, Tony and I, my co-author and I, started writing this book after 2011 when we felt like, with Occupy certainly in the U.S., but many similar movements elsewhere, including Arab Spring, movements in Spain and Greece, then in Turkey in 2013, like really powerful social movements, which had posed the need for and imagined alternatives to the current capitalist order, you know, if you like, that would link it back to your question, but had been so inspiring, but had not managed to enact and make lasting the kinds of transformations they imagined. So the start of the book was, in a way, trying to ask questions that we thought many activists were asking in the U.S. and elsewhere, which is, how could these movements, which are so inspiring, actually become more effective and enact more lasting changes? That's where we started. That's the question we started with.
All right. Well, let's start. I mean, it was between my question and Occupy I was going to ask, and I couldn't make up my mind until that last moment. But so what do you think? I mean, I guess in terms of Occupy, What is your sense of I mean, why was there that failure of realizing what was imagined, but also what was imagined? I mean, because I'm not convinced that those two things aren't necessarily intertwined.
Right. You mean that the difficulty in imagining an alternative has to do some ways with the lack of bringing it about. Is that what you mean about the intertwined?
Yes,
yeah, indeed. That's a lovely formulation. Yeah, you're right. I mean, on the one hand, I think one should recognize how much of a success Occupy was. You know, it's always important, I think, to recognize that. You know, the foregrounding within the national media and other conversations about inequality in the U.S., about the problems of debt, the problems of student debt, various housing questions, these were all things that Occupy really put on the agenda. So there, you know, like, I guess before talking about any of its shortcomings, I guess I just want to remember many ways in which it was a great success. In fact, I would say something like, the Bernie campaign would have been unimaginable without Occupy.
Absolutely.
You know, that was in some ways a transformation. So anyway, we're on the same board there. It's just like with other people, you know, I know you and I know where you are in this, but with other people, sometimes it's good first to recognize.
Right. I should say around these parts, it's understood that much of what we're seeing, both in terms of the questions that were asked in 2016 and the organizational structures in 2016. And I would go further in terms of like the Black Lives Matter movement. And I would say right. We see a whole host of these things, not to mention the fact that, like, I mean, in my assessment and that just the introduction of the word socialist as a sort of a common occurrence, as opposed to, you know, something that's rarefied, I would date to like somewhere around 2012, at least, right. You know, in the sort of like the common vernacular. I mean, it just, people just didn't talk about socialism in a sort of banal way until 2012.
I agree with you. So, like, once we recognize the importance of Occupy, like similar movements in other countries, then of course we do have to pursue the question about what it, how it could be more effective. The angle that Tony and I start from may be an obvious one, but is about the question of leadership and its relationship to the tradition of revolutionary and liberation movements across the 20th century. And we think that, I mean, maybe this is an obvious first recognition, is that this question about organization, the relationship to leadership, to charismatic leaders, et cetera, has radically changed. And I think mostly for the good. I mean, for the past even 50 years in a variety of movements, thinking in the U.S. context, from feminist movements, student movements, anti-racist movements, there has been an internal struggle against leadership, or rather centralized decision-making, put it that way, in the name of democracy and anti-authoritarianism. I mean, that's something we've seen, like I said, since the 1960s. What we have to, though, recognize then is how movements that are democratic can also be long-lasting and effective. And that's an organizational question. That's in some ways the first part of our book is trying to grapple with that, what I call it, a conundrum, at least a challenge, that I think the movements and activists themselves are posing and facing.
And I mean, just give us a. I mean, I think to a certain extent, what there's almost a. I don't want to say ad hoc. I mean, a suggestion of like ad hoc leadership, or I mean, what is the dynamic?
Well, so what Tony and I pose as a framework, which might be another way of saying what you were saying with ad hoc, is we talk about it in terms of an inversion of strategy and tactics. And what we mean by this, I think it's something relatively simple, that traditionally the notion is that leadership has been responsible for strategy. In other words, recognizing long-term goals, recognizing the nature of the struggle in a global sense, and tactics instead, local, temporary, have been the responsibility of grassroots activists. And what we're thinking of is not an elimination of leadership, but rather an inversion of this relationship, so that strategy could be democratically determined. You know, so like we say, strategy be the responsibility of the multitude or of the movements. And tactics instead would be the responsibility of leadership. So that leadership would be something that you said ad hoc, which is a good way of saying it. We're thinking, so this deployed and dismissed when needed, for when specialized knowledges are needed, when there's need for rapid decisions, something like that. So in some ways that, I mean, I think that's not the most difficult part of that equation that I just said about this inversion, is not so much the tactical leadership, like the ways of restricting leadership to specific decisions. The harder part is to say, how could strategy, how could the planning of our future and making the big decisions that really matter, how could they be determined democratically? Or even harder, how is it that people would be capable together of making such decisions? I mean, that's the real body of our book, of this investigation, is really trying to establish how today and how it could be transformed so that this is possible, so that people could democratically, and movements could democratically, be able to be responsible for strategy, which, like I say, is really just making the important decisions about the kinds of struggles that are ahead.
And I would add to that, in terms of a challenge, is also how do you pick those ad hoc tactical, those leaders, right? I mean, yeah. On some level, that's a tactical decision. We need Betty to be in charge of this for the next this project, essentially.
Right. In some ways we're, and I think this is always true about my and Tony's work, is that in some ways we're naming something that's already happening. And so rather than think of this as like here's a proposal, you all should go out and do it, it's rather trying to way to understand what activists are already doing. So those kinds of decisions, like you're just talking about, I think are already, there are already structures for them. It's often they're not seen.
Give us an example of that, like a concrete example of where you have a movement that is sort of at least coalesced around a broad strategy, and we see these sort of ad hoc leaders. I mean,
here's BLM, here's the most banal example that everyone comes to, which is that at any good demonstration, you need some people who are aware of where the police are moving, what streets they're blocking off, who's getting arrested, what to do when people are arrested. And this is really a, like you're saying, ad hoc, or I could say tactical leadership function. You know, that there is essentially a security team, a legal team, something like that. Those are the kind that are deployed and dismissed in ways that that seem useful and that don't impinge on, like you were saying, the broadly agreed on general frameworks about what we're aiming for and what we're aiming to do. That would be one, I don't know, that's the most small scale, maybe banal example. Here's another example, which seemed in a very different framework, I suppose. There was discussion in Berlin some years ago about making the electric system of the city common, like making the electric system neither public property, as it had been until 1989, or private property, as it had been since 1989, you know, run by corporations, but instead make it open to collective decision-making on the municipal basis. So here strategy be something like, what are the sources for energy? Like, should there be nuclear energy or not? How much should people be charged? You know, should the poor have to pay the same rates? Stuff like that would be the strategic decisions that should be made democratically at the city level. But there are, of course, about electricity, like, not everyone's an expert. There should be some decisions that have to be made by people who know electrical engineering or professionals of certain regards. So that these are the people, of course, who advise the politicians right now. And the politicians, of course, aren't any great geniuses. The proposal would be really that there be democratic mechanisms for making those decisions with certain expert or leadership ad hoc, as you were saying, positions. Does that make sense as a different kind of example?
Yes. I'm just still curious as to how those people get picked, right? I mean, when you give the example about the security team or the ad hoc security teams, in a demonstration, it's the guy who happened to show up with a radio scanner, right? Or
the people willing to do it.
Or the people willing to do it.
I mean, one thing is, it reduces the, once we're calling leadership something that's not responsible for setting the big agenda, making the big decisions, then it reduces the pressure a lot on who's chosen to do it.
Right.
It's no longer something that there has to be a great deal, at least in most cases, of consternation about. You know, at least in the kind of examples we've just been giving, because the important decisions are not going to be made by them. The important decisions are going to be made elsewhere. You know, so part of what we're trying to work through here is the need for democracy, the demand for democracy, even within social movements, and how that can still function in a way that construct lasting institutions and have lasting structures. So rather than our strategy, or no, I shouldn't say strategy again, our rhetorical move of talking of not eliminating leadership, but giving it a different role, is a way of trying to satisfy the need for democracy and a simultaneous need for lasting and coherent decision-making structures.
Okay, and so now, so let's move on. What this idea of organizing power, I guess, is meant to address. And then I'd like to circle back to social movement unionism, because I think that's, right. You know, but let's talk about what this form of organizing and organization is meant to address, and just sort of your ideas of where we are in terms of the development of capitalism. Specifically, I'm talking about the sort of the digital cognitive capitalism that you write about.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the one thing that's meant to address is the critics of the recent so-called leaderless movements, who insist that because of their defeats, we have to retreat to older organizing models. You know, the ones who would say to Occupy or to Black Lives Matter, you'll never be successful until you find your new ex, Martin Luther King, or, you know, name your historic charismatic leader.
Right.
And so the first response to such claims, I think, is that that is the most unrealistic proposal, because the movements themselves have made it no longer an option to return to such centralized structures behind charismatic male leaders. I mean, that's one thing that Black Lives Matter has made clear from its inception. And so you could say then, oh, well, like, we're doomed. If we can no longer, you know, if the person's thinking, oh, well, we can either have this chaotic leaderless and ineffective form, or we have essentially a failed attempt to return to some older structures. And really our point is that those aren't our only alternatives. And so what you and I've just been talking about for the last bit is a ways of thinking out of that conundrum. You know, it's recognizing that those aren't our only two choices. You know, either return to the Vanguard Party or to the Leadership Council or some other structure behind the charismatic leader, or effectiveless, leaderless, ineffective structure. So that's where we're. I mean, that's at the organizational model, but you know, the other thing I guess I should point out about this, and this could help us transition to that next point you had, is that I found that these organizational questions, if they're only posed in political terms like this, often end up turning around on themselves and not really getting anywhere. That you have to quickly move on to what I think of as the social terrain to recognize what people's capacities are, and what people can do together. In fact, so Tony and I shift in many ways thinking about cooperation and social cooperation instead of just posing these questions in political organizational terms. In order to imagine democracy being possible, in other words, that we could collectively decide together over political questions, you have to recognize that people are capable of it, find ways that people could become capable of collective decisions. So that's what, for at least for Tony and I, it's on the social terrain and even in the framework of economic relations that we have the means of exploring people's capacities for social cooperation, which would allow for democratic decision making.
Give us an example of what you're talking about in that sort of social, non-political type of cooperation. Are we just talking about, drinking clubs?
Well,
or maybe that's
thinking
too
more
revealing
so
of where I am these days. But bowling leagues, I guess.
I was thinking more at Here's a somewhat old-fashioned, but I think it's easy to update it one. At a certain point, you know, I've been thinking about October Revolution with its anniversary and such. At a certain point, Lenin says just before the revolution, he says, look, democracy certainly is our goal, but people as they are now, even says human nature as it is now, they have a master at work, they have hierarchical organization and work structures, and therefore they need a master in politics. This is his logic. And so in some ways, without affirming that same statement, I think the logic is worth thinking about, which is the kinds of abilities people have in their daily lives about democratic decision-making and cooperation give an indication to their capacities to do these things politically. And so even looking at work, like what are the forms of cooperation and collective decision-making what are people's capacities in that kind of cooperative decision making at work, and that could be an indication of what people are capable of in politics.
Your cat seems to agree.
She certainly does agree.
Well, but I mean, so if I hear you correctly, it is the idea is either is it to measure people's ability to operate more collectively in other contexts to see where they are, or is the idea to start to increase the collectivism in other contexts, which will basically train people and reorient people to have a more collectivist perspective, which can then be applied in politics?
I think I would say both of those, if I'm understanding you right. And it really cooperation is what I'm aimed at. But yeah, collective decision-making cooperatively. Maybe I just need to step back a minute, which maybe this is an already obvious point. I was thinking there are many authors who have said these sort of things in the past. W.E.B. Du Bois is one who comes to mind for me right now, who said something like, you shouldn't expect people to be capable of democracy by nature. It's not, one isn't instinctively capable of democracy. One has to, that's something that has to be a social training about, even historically. And so partly what we're thinking here is that the kinds of cooperation that people are engaged in social production, like not only production at wage labor, but other forms of social production, that's a terrain for both, like you're saying, measuring and increasing people's capabilities of acting cooperatively, making cooperative decision making, so cooperation in some ways is the measure here.
So, I mean, are you seeing any indices? I mean, what indices do you look at? I mean, I things that come to mind to me could be anything from like a co-op supermarket to the fact that like my daughter now, you know, uses House Party app and is talking to like seven of her friends, and you know, they that's not something that I had as a kid. You know, it was like maybe you make plans with one other person and then you sort of daisy chain it out, as opposed to seven people sort of deciding we're all going to, I don't know, go to, Shake Shack or something.
That, I mean, I think I see what you mean. Here's another frame. Maybe it actually intersects with what you're saying. Like if one thinks about the city or the metropolis as, and even the value of a city or value in a city is not just the built environment, but also the entire set of social relations and cultural interactions. These are things that are, even when you think about the value of one neighborhood over another, of course it has to do with, you know, the apartments that are built and the built environment in general, proximity to transport, parks, etc. But it also has to do with something quite immaterial, which is constructed by the residents themselves, the cultural nature of the neighborhood, the social relations in the neighborhood, like that this the city itself is this I would say like a repository for the value that's created by people's interactions in community life. So think that is a circuit, it seems to me, of it's even the production of economic values, it seems to me, which are then really taken up or extracted by real estate values and financial speculation. But the value itself is created cooperatively by people in the city, like in working with each other. You know, so it's not, I mean, what's nice about this example, it's not a work relationship. It's not something you're doing for a wage, but it's still constructing social and economic values by cooperating with others in the city, which, you know, it could take a formalized form of, you know, creating a community garden or something like that. But I'm more interested in the way in the informal nature that similar kinds of productions are always happening. Focusing on them might be, it's a specific example I just gave, but at least it's pointing towards the kinds of cooperation I'm talking about.
So it's not just mutual aid projects, but also even much less formalized, walk out your door and I'm going to help you fix your stairs type of situation.
Yeah. Right. It doesn't, always even take that, that form of what do you call it? Good Samaritan-ness. I think that's right. I mean, it also then the we do also, and it's important to. I mean, I shouldn't shy away from thinking about it also in the realm of wages and the kind of things you do at work and the things you know for a job, because those are also ones in which forms of cooperation and managing social relations. It's another way of recognizing how that's what people's capacities are.
And
yeah, let me give you an example. I don't know if this is a work example that any example I give is going to be partial. So bear with me with the thing. One example is think about the hospice nurse that works with, you know, a dying person during the last 6 months of life. This is of course, you know, paid operation. It involves, really mostly affective kind of work because, I mean, like all health professionals, they do many material things. You know, they'll tend to the medication of the person or tend to wounds, et cetera. But most of what they do is they manage the relationships with family members, with friends, helping the person die themselves. That's incredible kind of emotional work. But it also involves, just to link back to other discussion, a real construction of relations of cooperation. Like that's among all the people, the surrounding,
right,
the person that the nurse is caring for. So it really demonstrates a kind of capacities for cooperation. Like, I'm not saying that this is some idealized position. The hospice nurse you could think of as like more horribly alienated than other kinds of work because just that capacity you have to love and to maintain friendship networks, et cetera, is exactly what you're doing for a job. I mean, so in some ways, I'm not posing as ideal, I'm just recognizing the capacities for creating cooperation that are implied in such kind of work. And part of what Tony and I are arguing is that there's becoming more generalized these the capacities to produce social cooperation, like both in and outside the job. And there's a strong overlap between that ability to produce cooperation and the ability for democratic decision making. Those are two things that we see as overlapping.
Okay. So let me ask you two questions. One are you arguing that we're seeing more of that, or that this is a sort of a static quality in society, or are we seeing less of it? And then secondly, how would you promote that? Is that where something like a social movement unionism comes in? How would you generate that?
That's a lot. there. I mean, for the first bit, we do argue that it is increasing people's capacity to produce cooperation. It is increasing. And so, here's the historical claim. Like all of our claims, they're quite large. The claim is that whereas in the industrial era, cooperation was primarily imposed from above, in the current era of social production, cooperation primarily arises from below. That's our claim. So the above part is really, when you think about the factory itself, the capitalist is really responsible for cooperation. The capitalist provides a place for people to work. It gives them the tools to work. It forces on them the discipline to cooperate with each other. Cooperation comes from above. In the kinds of examples like we were just talking about, cooperation primarily is constructed from below. It's still exploited. I don't mean that it's not right, but it's just generated differently. That's the claim. And how this could be furthered, it probably does relate. I mean, this can tie us back to the earlier discussion, this question about social unionism. In part, what we're thinking about here is a merging of the energies and structures of traditional labor organizing and social movements. Today we perhaps see some examples of, and we can see the benefits of the bringing them together. So, in part, what it would be that the structures and institutions of labor unions could benefit social movements in providing lasting forms for them, but also the social movements could contribute to the labor movements their antagonism, their creativity, and their extension across social space, you know, outside of limited, you know, nature of different, at least traditional labor organizing. So that our logic for this is from social production, which is the kind of thing we were just talking about, from social production to social unionism to social strike. Like thinking of social strike as the
end goal.
Practice that social unionism can put in play, in some ways thinking that, you know, the social movement has been able to riot, and the labor movement has been able to strike at the points of production together, recognizing the points of production at a broader social scale, like outside of the factory space. Social unionism could, in this form of social strike, could block the social space, like block the city, as a form of production itself.
So, I mean, if I hear you correctly, what you're talking about is not actually necessarily a measure of cooperation, but a measure of self-initiated cooperation. I mean, it also seems to me, what also occurs to me is like, this is something in rural areas that seems maybe this is a little idyllic on my part, but not in my experience, that in rural areas, there's a little bit more of this because there's a lot less structures, period. And, you know, stuff's got to get done, and you got to help somebody do it so that when you need something done, they're going to help you do it. And that may be in, like, it's, on some level, it suggests to me that when we're faced with something like Janus, this court case that's undoubtedly going to really kneecap public sector unions, because they're not going to have the agency fees they need to pay their staff to negotiate contracts, that it's going to require unions to develop, to structure themselves in such a way that there is sort of self-generated incentives in the workers to pay for these agency fees.
Right.
And they're going to have to develop this sort of sense of like, I mean, so, I mean, it seems like this is, this impetus is born out of necessity on some level. And I mean, is that the part of the argument as well?
Absolutely. I mean, and it's similar with the question about that leadership and so-called leaderless movements. It's not a matter of abandoning the one. Like, I would certainly argue against abandoning the long traditions of labor organizing, but rather trying to imagine it in a new context. To continue, I mean, in some ways there are, like there are many social movements that are transforming in the ways I've just been talking about. There are many labor unions that are trying to, either externally ally with social movements or internally trying to incorporate elements of social movements and go outside of the thing. But like you say, by necessity, I think the labor movement in the U.S. as elsewhere is both essential and in need of, now I'm saying commonplace things, in need of a kind of rejuvenation and an extension across social issues that go outside of the workplace narrowly conceived.
So
this call for social unionism is really just recognizing that necessity.
All right. Well, so let me ask you, because, we need to, how would you want a reader of this to sort of begin to contemplate, I guess, putting these ideas in practice in some way?
So this might not be a good response. I know it always irritates my co-author, but I've been proud of the books we've written before because I consider them completely unoriginal. Like unoriginal that we're really just trying to reflect on and gather together what people are already doing. And I think that's at least partly true. So the question then is not, for a reader to approach this and say, here are some ideas, how do I put them in action? It's rather recognize how these things are already being done, and then perhaps with a way of conceptualizing them and even putting together different ideas and different things that are going on in different places might actually forward them. But it seems a little different to me than finding ideas in a book and then putting them in action. It's more like trying to reflect on what's already, like I would prefer rather than the what is to be done question, I prefer the what are people already doing question. And then recognizing even the kind of theorizing that goes on among activists and movements and then how it can reflect on that. So it's more like a cycle of thinking through these issues.
I think that's an agenda, is to go out and recognize where these things are happening, understand their value and why they're valuable, and come up with your own ideas on how to, perpetuate them and increase their...
And develop them. Yeah, right.
Well, that works.
That's good. I like that. Yeah.
That's the subtitle of the book.
You know these books that have these really long subtitles?
We were talking in the office today, like, it's refreshing to see a book with one word. And I'm like, where's the colon that says, and how you can take it back? Or something.
Right, and how you can do it in 12 easy steps that would then do, that would be the kind of subtitle. I agree with you. I'm myself in favor of one-word titles, so... But I see the logic of where you're going with that.
Well, I appreciate your talking to us about it. It's fascinating work, and thanks so much for coming on and discussing it.
Thanks to you. It's a pleasure.
Michael Hart from Duke University. The book is Assembly: Heretical Thought. We will put a link to it on our blog. Once again, thanks again.
Right.
Right. All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half in a bit. I should tell you what we will get to. We will get to that in just a moment. I just saw some breaking news. Apparently, convicted former coal CEO Don Blankenship is going to be running for U.S. Senate, presumably in West Virginia. He is the CEO, the former CEO of Massey Energy. And here's a guy who served a one-year sentence in federal prison to conspire, to violate mine safety standards that led to the deaths of multiple individuals, 29 miners, if I remember correctly. I believe this was in 2010. And, wow, must be nice. You want to get back in there. A little reminiscent of Tom DeLay, who wanted to get into politics because he didn't appreciate the federal government telling him they couldn't use carcinogenic products to kill pests.
Is that really?
Yes.
His story?
Yeah. And hopefully, Blankenship will get into office and reform that, reform those onerous mine safety laws that make folks like him responsible for the safety of their employees.
That's like the agenda is to make it like Wall Street, make all the criminal activity legal.
Exactly. Bring back coal. All right. Well, anyways, folks, so let me tell you about my day yesterday. Of course, it was my birthday, and this is how I always like to celebrate my birthday. When I got off the subway, I checked my Twitter, and as I like to do, and because I'm still in the habit of like pulling stories at all times, even though I was in like birthday mode.
Birthday mode for a Sam Cedar?
It's just like
we were actually trying to speculating on this when you left yesterday. Like, what is he gonna do?
Just Chinese food. My neighbors came over. Benjamin came over. That was basically it. My sister and nothing special. Kids made some very nice cards for me. I was willing to wrap it up then. But so I get off Twitter. I mean, I get off the subway. I'm checking on Twitter and I see that two people have retweeted a tweet of mine from 2009. Can we put that up on the screen? Do you have it? Yeah, here it is. Zoom in there. And it was from 2009. And I had written, "Don't care, Re Polanski. But I hope if my daughter's ever raped, it's by an older, truly talented man with a great sense of mise-en-scene." And I thought about it and I realized like this was back in 2009, and I think it happened like twice over the past 10 years. There was an attempt to get, I think, Roman Polanski like a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Academy Awards, and people in the film business, which in 2009 I still felt relatively close to show business, and I saw some big name people who I was, you know, friendly with or knew or didn't know, make excuses for this guy and saying that, you know, and I should just back up. There is a lot of evidence. Well, not even a lot of evidence. I believe he was either convicted or was set to face trial on the rape of a 13-year-old girl who had been drugged, and I can't remember the specifics of it, but at the time I had dug into it quite a bit. And he had left the country, and there was a lot of people who were advocating, and I don't know why there was a push, maybe there was a documentary about him, and I found it disgusting. And people were citing his artistic abilities. And so in that tweet, I was attempting to show people just how sort of gross what they were suggesting was, that somehow a rape of a 13-year-old, and I don't mean to make it that specific, was, you know, can be forgiven because it's years later and he's a really talented director. He's given us so many great films.
Chinatown.
And so during that time, I also said I've been reviewing Polanski's IMDb page, and I cannot believe, quote unquote, they want to hold him accountable for raping a 13-year-old. I mean, this is what my assessment, I suppose you'd call it a joke, but it was really more of like a satirical or ironic way of expressing, you know, my outrage. And then later, I guess in 2012, this came back up again, and I was in an exchange with somebody, and I specifically said, and Polanski defenders are offensive, in my humble opinion. And I went on to say, I'm not sure how people are defining accused, but Polanski was wanted for far more than questioning. They had already, you know, gone past the questioning stage. And he had taken off. So I saw that tweet, but I was just like, yeah, I mean, I absolutely stand by that tweet. But I saw two people who were clearly not followers of mine, who MAGA people had retweeted it. And I was like, screw this. I'm going to delete it because I'm not, you know, the president of the United States. These are not historical records. I didn't think this stuff was going to be put in the Smithsonian. Sometimes people retweet something that I wrote nasty about Marc Maron. You know, maybe this happened, I don't know, 6-8 months ago. I wrote something that was, you know, not mean, but it wasn't nice. And I saw it and I was like, I'm going to delete it. It's just laziness.
I want to do better. Let me delete.
So I come home. I go down to the supermarket to get some milk and some paper plates because I was like, hey, it's my birthday. We're not going to wash dishes tonight. And I get a text. Dude, Mike Cervonich is like all over you on Twitter. And I realized like, oh, God. This was something different. So let me start with this. I want to make a sincere apology. I should have never deleted that tweet because the sentiment I totally 100% agree with, I will defend it. People want to take exception with my use of the word rape in the context of this. This is not a rape joke. It was a joke about how disgusting, and to the extent that it was even a joke, it was to show just how disgusting people were, how disgusting what people were proposing was, that you could forgive this based upon the guy's talent. So I want to apologize for deleting it. And, you know, I'm contemplating maybe just retweeting the screenshot of it. But if Mike Cervonich was a little bit more pronounced as a figure, you know, maybe I would do that if it was necessary. But
pronounced?
I
see what you did there.
Oh, I'm sorry. But I think it's ironic that Mike Cervonich thought that this would, I don't know what he was hoping to do. I guess he was trying to get MSNBC to fire me as a contributor, which, you know, maybe they will. I don't know why they would. I'm always surprised that I'm still there day in, day out, frankly, for a myriad of reasons. But the idea that Mike Cervonich thinks that that's a scalp, I think he's got, he's very, very mistaken. First off, let's just let Mike Cervonich try and articulate what the relevance of a 9-year-old tweet is. Apparently, he tweeted out a lot of alt-right tweets, but they were 2 years ago. Go ahead, let's play this.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I have to say I'm not alt-right. It gets a little bit old, right? They dig up a tweet. Well, 2 years ago. 2 years ago. Yeah, 2 years ago, bro.
Yeah, bro.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, but there's he was saying alt-right. Sometimes somebody says, like, what does that mean? I'm all right. No, he's alt-right.
Yeah, it was alt-right. It was all right.
And it was 2 years ago.
2 years ago, it was all right.
But listen, here's the other thing I want to say to Mike Cervonich. Am I pronouncing his name right?
Mike Cernovich.
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 Fuck a tad.
Listen, obviously, we've hurt your feelings when we mocked that really, really, really hysterically bad audition that you had on InfoWars that actually like created a genre of really bad auditions on InfoWars.
Oh, that was bad, man.
I mean,
we actually felt for you.
There was a certain empathy. There was a certain amount of empathy. I mean, look, it's not easy doing this. I don't particularly think that I'm that great at it, but I also know that I can't go on a show with someone really great and expect not to come off looking like an ass.
You came on with the king, man.
Yeah.
Alex Jones and is you very just, good at what he does.
You know, listen, you got your alimony. You're living large. I think you should just be happy that you're a kept man. Because listen, I would love that opportunity to have.
That's very true.
Yeah, honestly. I mean,
you said that you've talked about, you call it a Cernovich option many times.
Oh, yeah.
We're all dreaming this.
We're all dreaming of
Cernovich dream.
And your wife seems super excited about your opportunities going forward. Well, here, let's take a look at this again. Just in case people forgot.
Can we please rewatch this?
What a disaster this was for Mike. I mean, so much so that your wife, now is this the current wife? I don't know.
The alimony's from the old wife.
Oh, okay.
The current wife is the one who's like, you're special, which is why you're bad
right.
at TV, sweetie.
Right, that's right. That's right. Let's see how special Mike is on TV. Here we go.
Eroded. I mean, these Democrat-run cities are sinking into the mud, and here is Rahm Emanuel demonizing the president trying to save the economy.
Right, because he has no answers. He has no answer for the violence. He has no leadership. While there, how many people are shot every weekend in Chicago? 30 to 50 people some weekends are shot.
One second. The look on Alex Jones' face. What he really... Like he's waiting for Rahm Emanuel's voice, and he just hears Cernovich say.
And I have to tell you, because enjoying Alex Jones is one of those weird things.
Look on Alex Jones' face.
I've shared this with so many people who have they don't care for this. They're like, why are you showing me these horrible people? This isn't funny. This clip has scored with
every
weekend
single person. In Chicago, 30 to 50 people some weekends are shot.
And then I like how
record numbers of murders
looks
in Chicago.
Over,
and rather than deal
he actually
with
makes the
problems,
first
he virtue signals,
here he goes. Stop it for one second. He's looking over for some type of like encouragement, and he doesn't get it. So
it's
he's
a
just
globalist.
He just
Wait,
comes.
Nothing?
He just comes looking back, and his eyes just start going as he's talking. And I think that's because he's starting to panic and realize, like, oh, God, Alex Jones seems steaming mad at me. But go ahead.
Hillary lost. This is why the Democrats keep losing.
By the way, do we not have that clip? Because there's a press conference. Oh, it's ready. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and play that clip.
In other words, everything you're saying is really irrelevant, and you're annoying the hell out of me. Enjoy your last time here.
Oh, it's ready. Right. Okay, please. If you could escort yourself out of the building.
But listen, and the thing is, the thing that I do, and I think the reason why that's so funny is because it's so human. Yeah. It's so human. And I think, one could have some sympathy with Mike. On one hand, he's got this alimony that's paying for his lifestyle, right? And I imagine, and I hope you're saving, putting at least, you know, a certain amount away, maybe in some type of savings vehicle. An IRA or something like that. Very important to do, Mike. Because even though you're the type of guy who, let's say, a staffer in Congress will leak to you information like on John Conyers, understand they're doing that because you are so far removed from them that there's no way to trace it back. And here's what's going to happen to you, Mike, is that you're going to age out. Your contacts are just going to, they're going to move on. And because you're so toxic right now, you're not going to develop the ones that you need. So you got maybe a couple more years at this. But at one point, you're going to age out. And the problem is, I look at that video and I say, here's a guy who does not have the skill set he's going to need, because that's where you would go. You would go and be an Alex Jones type. And I'm just concerned that he doesn't have the skill set to carry that.
We're going to need to put him out to pasture.
Well, honestly, and it's like, you know, YouTube is only 10 years old. This whole thing where you go on and just, you know, you're sitting in your T-shirt and, you know, arguing with people who are tweeting comments on you, that's going to get old too, man. Maybe a podcast, but then there's that other issue that it might,
audio medium.
It's an audio medium, and that might be sort of tough on the ears.
Yeah, his voice. If I couldn't see that he was a human person in that clip, I would have thought, like, man, Sylvester the cat's really fallen in with the wrong crowd.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, but or maybe there's some animation opportunities.
Mm.
But
that would be a very, you know what?
But I want to encourage everyone to go deep into my Twitter archives, because I got to imagine there's something worse than me going out there and slamming people who are defending a child rapist. Like, can you imagine defending a child rapist just because of his film work? Or let's say defending a child rapist just because he represents the same political party you do.
Yeah, that would be pretty obscene.
That would be just disgusting. In fact, can you imagine going out and trying to create distractions that don't work so that the story of a child rapist, of a child molester, of a child assaulter could be elected to the U.S. Senate? That's super, super sad. All right, we got to take a break, head into the fun half of the program. Wherein we will take your phone calls. And if Mike Cervanich wants to call in, apparently he sent an email asking for...
I am calling in with a troubled con artist.
He sent an email wanting to get a comment from us last night.
He's a journalist.
He's a journalist.
Are you going to throw the breaking news music on for that? Comment on... over 7-year-old deleted tweet. Should have said, it's 2 years ago. 2 years ago. 9 years ago. I was condemning rape 9 years ago. I actually will still do that.
Yes.
I guess it was maybe more like I was defending the worst people and associating with the worst people in the country 2 years ago. And now I'm just the bag man for other horrible people.
There you go. All right, we're going to take a quick break, 646-257-3920. We will take your phone calls and your IMs back in a moment.